Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It's the 29th day of May, 2009. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo, Risk Management Commodities Incorporated out of Lafayette, Indiana. And then later in the half hour, we'll hear from Steve Hilberg. He's the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, right here at the Illinois State Water Survey, and it's all located on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
Taking a look, not at the numbers on this Friday afternoon, because actually I'm out of the office and we recorded yesterday with Mike Zuzulo, Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, Indiana, but talking a bit about our website here at the radio station and the things that we offer that you might be interested in, including willag.org, that's willag.org, where you can listen to this program anytime you'd like or sign up to have it delivered to you automatically as a podcast at all at willag.org. You can even listen to us on the phone if you'd like. We update our phone system at 10:15 and 3:15 daily, and we update that with some numbers and a bit of an analysis after the opening and the closing of the marketplaces in Chicago. And don't forget that while you're on our website, you can also sign up for our free weekend newsletter. It's a very good newsletter. Dave Dickey, your Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media, takes care of writing it. And if you have interest, sign up for it over on the right-hand side at willag.org. If you don't like the newsletter, it's just as easy to get off that list. Just go back to willag.org and hit unsubscribe over on the right-hand side of the page. If you get the opportunity, you're already signed up. One more thing I'd like you to do, visit that site and hit manage. And if you can give us a bit more information on yourselves, we'd appreciate that. That's all at willag.org. Mike Zuzulo will be here in just 2 minutes. He'll help us take up the agricultural futures markets on this Friday afternoon, the 29th day of May.
It's National Coco Van Day. Legends trace the French fricassee of rooster dish to ancient Gaul and Julius Caesar, but the earliest written records do not appear until the 20th century. On this day in agricultural history in 1630, Charles II, King of England, was born. Merry Monarch tea was introduced to England during his reign. On December 23rd of 1675, he issued a proclamation suppressing coffee houses. But the public response was so negative that he revoked it just over a year later. In 1716, Louise Jean-Marie d'Aubuton was born, a French naturalist and pioneer in several fields, including plant physiology. He also conducted agricultural experiments and introduced Merino sheep to France. In 1855, Sir David Bruce was born, an English bacteriologist. He traced the Malta fever to a bacterium later named for him. Malta fever causes abortion in goats and is usually transmitted by goat's milk. In 1886, Coca-Cola, invented by pharmacist John Pemberton in 1885, was advertised for the first time in the Atlanta Daily. And in 2004, tens of millions of pounds of almonds were recalled by one of the world's largest almond producers, located in California, due to a salmonella outbreak. At least 25 people were sickened in states from Alaska to Michigan. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lerner Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Asgrow's new Roundup Ready 2-yield soybeans. Lerner Seed Service provides services to help customers in East Central Illinois maximize profits. 217-497-2270.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Friday afternoon. On the line with us today is Mike Zuzlo of Risk Management Commodities Incorporated out of Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hey there, Todd.
Hey, very quickly, we probably should tell the listeners that it's actually Friday afternoon when they're listening to this, but we recorded on Thursday afternoon because Dave Dickey is out of the office, and so am I, so you graciously decided to donate your time on a Thursday and stay in the office a bit late there in Indiana. Thanks so much for doing that. I appreciate it.
You bet. Anytime.
So let's talk about the marketplace as you view it at this point. And it's an interesting year, I think, to this point because of the late season in a large part of the Eastern Corn Belt. It's kind of the opposite of what we saw last year. And the marketplace itself is trying to take all of this in and decide whether a 1.1 billion bushel corn carryout by the time we get to the fall of 2010 is worth paying very much attention to. And it doesn't seem that they've done that so far. Why is that the case?
Well, I think most of it goes back to so far the trade has kind of taken bits and chunks out of the market in terms of its psychology, in terms of its sentiment, Todd. I think it goes back to the beans were the first thing that the market wanted to deal with because they were the most pressing issue when it came to the supply and demand fundamentals. Obviously, I think, you know, if you put the word corn in for beans as far as China buying, I think you would have had a whole different market in this past 3 months. In other words, China came in and bought beans. And because China bought beans, the beans were the ones that were put under the microscope and were the ones that really were jumped on by the funds, jumped on by the Chicago people, and jumped on by the fact that the supplies of the old crop beans just aren't out there like they were. The market has done a very, very good job of prying loose the farmer supplies of old crop beans. I had that conversation this week with one of my clients. He said, of course, you know, we're dancing on $12 beans again, and it's probably because I let mine go back during the lows of November, December, because I was so nervous about everything. And, you know, I think that's what the market had done to the trade in terms of the farmer perspective and the farmer aspect, is the farmers let go of the beans quickly because they were still, after all, right around $8 cash. Producers kind of had in their mind, I'm not going to let it go below $8. Corn, we haven't seen that as much. China's not bought corn, and we still have quite a few bushels to let go of in the corn market. But you see wheat is starting to gain traction here, and I think as our leader, that's the nice setup that we're coming into the early part of summer, that the corn has some good potential. Notice this week that July 2010 wheat is now hitting up around $7.25, something you just don't see very often in the last 10 years for a new crop wheat price.
Can you go back to the soybean in China for just a bit for me? Can you recap, if possible, the reasons fundamentally just politically as to why it would be that China would be in the marketplace so heavily for soybeans so often this season?
I think part of it goes back to the melamine scare, and part of it goes back to the blue ear disease for the hogs. The blue ear disease did a big job of whittling down their hog production domestically. The melamine scare did a big job of slapping down their available feed supplies. And I think, quite frankly, they had to rebuild those supplies. Along comes South America, along comes the United States with some weather problems, and along comes also the financial problems we're having and these huge reserves that the Chinese hold in terms of dollar assets and dollar reserves and currency reserves. All those kind of came together all at once and kind of made the tip of the spear, if you will, and allowed China to come in and keep buying and buying and buying. I think they knew probably 6 or 7 months ago when the Brazilians were getting, you know, post-planting and we were wrapping up harvest, that there was going to be more of a shortfall in soybeans than anything else out there at the end of 2009. Or the end of the 2009 marketing year, 2008 marketing year, however you want to say it. I think that was probably the major five or six major catalysts that allowed for China to come in and buy. The other side of it goes back to what they've done here in the last 2 months, which is dollar related, and that is hoard and oversupply, build supplies and government stockpiles of copper, of crude, of soybeans, of many, many raw materials, natural resources. We're not sure whether they're doing that to stimulate their own domestic prices or whether they're doing that because they really see a surge in demand because of their stimulus they put in place by their government. Maybe it's a combination of both.
So let me see if I can't get back to a couple of the things that you stated there. The first, which was that blue ear disease, which is known as PERS here in the United States, blue ear is slightly different and much more virulent, apparently, and has a greater impact on their hog herd than PERS does in the U.S. and North America. But that had dwindled away part of their livestock because they needed to purge it from the livestock sector. And they coupled that with melamine, which meant that they needed to get rid of tainted feed sources. And so now they have less livestock to feed, coupled with probably what they saw as something decent, I would think, to hold prices up anyway, which was they had to get rid of supplies of a potential feed product, but it had to be eliminated, not sold.
Right.
And then they got to the point where they thought, well, we need to rebuild this hog herd, and they did not have the incentive internally to put that many beans in the ground to feed that much livestock.
Yes, because we're under the same type of scenario this year again in China. Even with the prices we have here in the domestic market and what they have at the Dalian Exchange, the Chinese government is still buying Chinese beans from their domestic producers, putting them in government warehouses, essentially taking them off the supply, off the market for available supply in order to spur their domestic prices again. So it's a very strange way of economics of how they control their prices over there. They're importing a tremendous amount, plus they're taking domestic quantities and taking them off the shelf, so to speak, so that the prices domestically are pulled up by both the import price and the fact they have lower supplies. But all that goes back to is that their talk is, the talk that we hear in Chicago and our contacts there is that they're running a six-month supply of beans now with the idea that at some point they're just going to stop buying because they don't need any more.
Right.
And so that's the whole heart and soul of, and that's where the corn comes into play, is you just haven't seen that in the corn, where there's no threat of the Chinese physically running us out of corn. And I've heard that from Chicago traders. You probably have too, where you've actually got traders believing that we're going to get so close to zero in old crop bean supplies here in the United States, and it's because China has literally run us out. So that's the major difference in psychology up at the Board of Trade right now versus the corn and beans, and obviously the wheat too.
Except that China wouldn't run us out. They'd stop buying first if they've got that much supply. It wouldn't be, I can't imagine what it might be that would be to their vantage point to continue to buy if they could just open the supply door on their end.
I think that's exactly right, unless they have the intention of eventually exporting after they have their supplies secure with new planted acres. You know, that's going to be the big thing in June. The weather in China and the ability of how big the acres are of corn and beans in those northern provinces.
All right. Well, that certainly makes for an interesting June, July, and August here, which is going to be really pretty interesting. I mean, you've got an Informa number out there that says 77. Some traders in Chicago think zero. USDA probably won't come up with anything that low. And then when I talked to Daryl Good earlier in the week, and we'll hear this during Commodity Week, which is should be already on the website by the time you hear this, that he thinks that in September, historically, we find more bushels of beans left from the old crop than we really thought were there.
I think that's really interesting, because this week we had the census report and we crushed fewer beans in April than we did in March, but yet we found more production or more supplies of both meal and bean oil. And so I think that goes back to, not only is there a lag like Dr. Good's probably inferring, but also under these types of circumstances and these types of years, we do see this demand rationing take effect, and I think that's what the census report probably showed us this week, and probably a big reason why the July and August beans continued to find a real tough time up until, you know, obviously we don't know what Friday's trade is talking here, but all this week the front-end beans continue to correct to the new crop, because the uncertainty is in the new crop, the old crop is kind of looked upon as, well, we know Argentina's number because they're done harvesting. We continue to hear reports of China canceling and being out of the market. And then you see the numbers like the census crush numbers that say, well, we're still crushing pretty good, but we sure are building a lot of meal and a lot of oil. And, you know, we were in a Dow Jones article earlier this week about another round of hog herd liquidation, and we're very fearful that that's going to happen here between June and August, that some producers are going to have to at least cut back some of their herd because they're dealing with, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 months of losses at this point. And obviously, meal's going to be a big reason for that.
Meal's going to be a big reason, a push in the corn market, maybe, too? As a reason for them to get rid?
I think the lack of DDGs, too. You know, the fact that we've slowed down the ethanol side means that we don't have as many DDGs available, and so now the producers have to go back to corn, you bet.
Yeah, so yesterday we heard on this program, Dan Zwicker talk about it in the Thursday program, about potential for the livestock herd to liquidate and liquidate quickly if we were to push the corn market higher. We concentrated primarily on corn with him. Rather than the soybeans we've done so far with you. And I asked him this question as well, if we liquidate part of that herd, is there fear on your part that we will liquidate it and export it?
Yes.
And so that it might not ever come back?
Correct, yeah. I think that's very likely in the small and medium-sized producers, if the countries that pick it up have good phytosanitary conditions. The larger producers, the mega producers that are in jeopardy right now of cutting back dramatically, it's due to financial and credit issues, and I would suspect that that's going to be a worldwide problem, that no country is going to be better than the United States right now in terms of producing pork or poultry, you know, if it's based upon solely credit. But that's the big issue that we have to work through here, is how many of these larger producers are going to go ahead and shut their doors down because their credit is dried up. And that's a real issue. In some of the contacts in Chicago, we have told us that as of late as 10 days ago, there are producers that are being talked to with their lenders and their banks saying, you got until about the end of June here, and if you can't turn things around at the end of June, we're not going to be able to give you a renewed line.
I think corn farmers in the Eastern Corn Belt are feeling bullish about the corn market because of what's outside their door.
Right.
They're fully feeling bullish about the soybean market because of the lack of old crop beans at this point. Where do you stand, old crop and new crop?
Well, we think that they're justified in their bullishness. I think the one thing, you know, you started off the conversation today about how things were different than last year in terms of this part of the Corn Belt having problems. It's amazing on the other side, and we talked about this a little bit last week, it's amazing how similar we are to last year in terms of trade sentiment. The Chicago traders are really getting excited about the upside potential because of the funds. The funds are coming back into stocks and commodities, and there was even a quotation today in the Wall Street Journal of some futures traders saying the funds are back in it just like they were last year. I can't tell you how much I feel that way, that it's absolutely weird to be sitting here and feeling the same way we did last year at this time in terms of speculative money flows coming in, when we've got the type of, you know, damage done to the economic and financial markets that we've seen the last 6 months. So where I stand is there is a chain on the upside. There is a leash on that dog, so to speak, as far as how high we can go, because I don't think we're going to have the same demand that we had last year or back in 07. So we're cautiously optimistic we're going to hit our overvalue levels, but we're sure going to sell once we hit those overvalue levels.
So it appears, and maybe you're the analyst here, so I'm going to throw something out, and then you tell me whether I'm right, wrong, or just indifferent about this. It appears that rebalancing of demand may be underway around the planet, so that we may, in the United States, lose a portion of the livestock sector, and that might go overseas. I don't know what happens, actually, with ethanol. As long as the political will is there, it stays. If
right.
not, then that's a true problem. But domestically, the American farmer, I don't think, would like to lose the livestock sector.
No, you can't.
Historically, it's been too valuable to them.
You can't. It's your rock. It's the foundation of our demand, and that's all there is to it. And when it comes to the ethanol, if you put ethanol and feed demand in the same camp as far as what causes the demand to go up and go down, what you're talking about is the overall economy, and you really don't want to get that sensitive. Your elasticity to your demand gets a lot more sensitive, and your peaks and your valleys get a lot rougher. And what I mean by that is no one has seen greater per capita consumption of meat than China because of their creation of their wealth. We all heard that. We all know that. Well, it goes back to the same thing that why do we spend so much money on gasoline and diesel fuel? Because we're richer. And so if we have countries like China and the United States and Japan and Europe all sitting there facing the same dilemma that their meat demand and their energy demand is based upon their pocketbook, their housing values, their whether they have a job or not, then you all of a sudden find yourself with business cycles that are much more violent. And we haven't had to go through that in agriculture because we've kind of been insulated because our domestic livestock industry has always been there for us.
So how fearful are you that the livestock sector could export? And I guess what part of the livestock sector would be exported in your mind?
Are we talking about the export? Yeah.
It would be pork, but are we talking about the export part of our livestock industry? So that part of it, which would normally be going overseas, so we grow the crop, we grow those hogs out, and then we ship them overseas or the product overseas. Is that the part that would disappear?
Yeah, I think the animals themselves. I think corn farmers would just stay with producing corn and not raise hogs anymore. Even if it's weaned to finish hogs, they wouldn't do that as much. It's too much risk.
Well, I was trying to get maybe I'm approaching it the wrong way. I was thinking that if you took a look at total hog production, you have those hogs that are used domestically and used, and then those that are exported. And it would seem to me that the export portion of our hog production might go away.
Well, I think that's true, and I think this last round with the H1N1 showed us that the Western Corn Belt between Japan and Mexico, the Western Corn Belt hog prices were the ones that really got slammed, never really came back after the flu was put down a little bit here in the last few weeks. And so I think if you're looking for a region, that's where I'm looking at and that's what I've heard anecdotally from our Chicago contacts, that
right. The
medium-sized people and the larger size in the Western Corn Belt are the ones that are going to get hurt, maybe not so much in our area.
Oh, interesting. So the question then is, Iowa, if farmer in Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska willing to give up their hog production, which has been historic?
It has, and that goes back to the basis levels, you know, and why ethanol and hog production has been so good out there, and it's because of their basis levels, and that's something we're really going to have to watch, because if they lose ethanol, if they lose hogs, and they stick with those bad basis levels, then all of a sudden the acres that were profitable in Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota that weren't profitable 10 or 15 years ago, maybe they go back to where farmland values go back down there first, and all of a sudden grain farming's not as profitable out there like it was back in the early 90s.
Oh, it gives us some really interesting things to think about, doesn't it?
You betcha.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Todd. Have a great weekend.
Hey, you too. That is Mike Zuzulo. He's with Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, joining us here on the Closing Mark Report. It is a Friday afternoon. Mike and I had our discussion yesterday afternoon on a Thursday.
The Closing Market Report is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at AgriGold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's National Coco Van Day. Legends trace the French fricassee of rooster dish to ancient Gaul and Julius Caesar, but the earliest written records do not appear until the 20th century. On this day in agricultural history in 1630, Charles II, King of England, was born. Mary Monarch Tea was introduced to England during his reign. On December 23rd of 1675, he issued a proclamation suppressing coffee houses. But the public response was so negative that he revoked it just over a year later. In 1716, Louise Jean Marie Daubertin was born. A French naturalist and pioneer in several fields, including plant physiology, He also conducted agricultural experiments and introduced Merino sheep to France. In 1855, Sir David Bruce was born. An English bacteriologist, he traced the Malta fever to a bacterium later named for him. Malta fever causes abortion in goats and is usually transmitted by goat's milk. In 1886, Coca-Cola, invented by pharmacist John Pemberton in 1885, was advertised for the first time in the Atlanta Daily. And in 2004, tens of millions of pounds of almonds were recalled by one of the world's largest almond producers, located in California, due to a salmonella outbreak. At least 25 people were sickened in states from Alaska to Michigan. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Closing Mark Report. It's a Friday afternoon. Steve Hilberg will be here in a moment from the Midwestern Regional Climate Center to take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
I'm Steve Hilberg with the NOAA Midwestern Regional Climate Center, located at the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign. After an extended period of dry weather last week, rain returned to Illinois again this week. A slow-moving upper-level low that affected Florida and the Gulf Coast last week moved northeast into Arkansas, then northeast into Iowa, before moving out of the region late this week. Bands of showers and thunderstorms streamed through Illinois, generally moving north to south when they did move. Storms over southwestern Illinois and southeastern Illinois were particularly heavy. One community collaborative rain, hail, and snow network station located in Edwardsville in Madison County measured 8.5 inches of rain between Monday morning and Thursday morning of this week. In southeastern Illinois, more than 5 inches of rain was measured at some locations. In contrast, some locations in central Illinois picked up only 0.5 inch or less during the week. It was more humid this week, of course, with the rain, and the clouds kept temperatures at or a little below normal. A cold front slowly dropping through Illinois will bring almost a daily chance for showers and thunderstorms next week, with rain most likely in northern Illinois. Rainfall amounts and coverage should decrease as you go further south in the state. Temperatures should be near to below normal north and normal to slightly above normal in the south next week. For the NOAA Midwestern Regional Climate Center in Champaign, I'm Steve Hilberg.
And I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Be sure to visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you can hear Steve Hilberg's forecast again, or this complete program, the Closing Mark Report, or even Commodity Week. We've already posted it there for this week at willag.org. That's willag.org. Have a safe weekend. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.